Back when I was in Bible college working on my bachelor's degree in theology, we were taking a class in which we were studying the Gospels. The class, fittingly, was called the Gospels. And when we got to Luke chapter 19, Luke chapter 8, the story that you just heard that Al read to you, the story of Jesus delivering the demons from this man and the demons going into the pigs and the pigs running down the bank into the water to be drowned, someone in the class said, "So what happened to the demons after the pigs all drowned?" And someone said, "They went into the fish. And that's why we have sharks." It is good to laugh. Not just to make the one telling the joke feel good, but because having a sense of humor is very helpful for our mental health. In fact, it's been discovered that that's the case. Laughter is vital. Laughter is important. Laughter and giving yourself over to that kind of joyous expression allows endorphins to be released into your system, which makes you feel good and helps you stay in a good frame of mind. Good mental health requires the opportunity to be able to laugh and to have a good sense of humor. Now, when we think about the different characters in the Bible, however, sometimes I think it'd be kind of hard to imagine that some of them might have a sense of humor. I mean, part of the reason for that is the stories that we read, of course, are pretty truncated. They're just focusing on the key essentials for us that need to know them. And so we don't really get the full story of all the personality of different people and so on. But nevertheless, the question can come. If laughter, if a good sense of humor is so important and all of that, how do some of our Bible characters do? What about Elijah? How much did Elijah laugh? What kind of sense of humor did Elijah have? In the first reading you heard from Donna this morning, he was anything but laughing. He was actually quite depressed. He was in quite a bit of despair. He was rather despondent. And when we look at that and consider the stature of Elijah, we might be kind of puzzled. I mean, Elijah is perhaps the greatest prophet in the Old Testament. When we see his role that he played in the Old Testament, it was a very important role. When you get to the New Testament, references made over and over again to Elijah as a significant prophet. When Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John, he is visited by two men. He's visited by Moses, and he is visited by Elijah. And to this day, when Jews gather for some of their key feasts, they will keep one chair empty, because that's Elijah's chair. And so Elijah has this huge profile in the history of both Judaism and Christianity. And yet, in the word that we heard this morning, he was not doing very well. He was suicidal. And we might ask ourselves the question, wouldn't someone who was right on the top of doing what God wanted to do be someone who should be at the peak of all things? Like, how could Elijah get to such a place like this? And what does that say to us to find that Elijah was in such a depressed mood? Well, to begin to answer that question, we do have to understand where he's come from and what the situation was. And for that, we have to go back a couple of chapters from what we heard read. And Elijah was called by God to be a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel. After the nation had split into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom had a series of kings who weren't interested in following Yahweh. They weren't interested in keeping the covenant with God. And one king in particular, Ahab, was not doing a very good job of this. And so Elijah was called as a prophet to proclaim God's truth, to proclaim the importance of the Torah again to King Ahab and saying, you've got to be following the covenant of God. But Ahab wasn't. In fact, as king, he went off and did something he shouldn't have done. He married a woman from outside of Israel. And it wasn't that he just simply married a woman to become one other person in his harem, but she became the queen. Her name was Jezebel. You might remember her name. We talked about her in the series in Easter about the seven letters to the seven churches in Jerusalem in Revelation. But he marries Jezebel. Jezebel was one who worshipped Baal, which was a Canaanite deity. And when she became the queen over the northern kingdom of Israel, she continued to worship Baal and encouraged Ahab to begin to worship Baal and continued her influence so much so that 450 Israelites decided to stop serving Yahweh and instead became prophets of Baal. And so their whole reason for being was to encourage more and more people to worship Baal. The first commandment given in the Torah was, I am the Lord your God and you will have no other gods before me. And yet Ahab and these 450 prophets were encouraging the Israelites precisely to do that. Elijah had to step in and address this situation. And so I wonder how long it was that he was talking and trying to say what needed to be said. But finally, things came to a head, and so he said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We gather up on Mount Carmel, and you 450 prophets of Baal, you're going to make an altar, and I'm going to make an altar. And then you're going to put a sacrifice on your altar, and I'm going to put a sacrifice on my altar. And then we're going to pray to our respective gods, and the God who responds with fire from heaven, that will be clear as to which one is actually God, either Baal or Yahweh. That's how we're going to determine it. You guys go first, I'll watch. And I think Elijah did have a bit of a sense of humor. Because I like to picture him sitting down with his back up against his altar, watching the 450 prophets of Baal get started on their attempts to get Baal to respond. And so the minutes become 15 minutes and a half an hour, and then hours. And they seem to be getting more and more fervent in their attempts to get Baal to pay attention. And Elijah begins to mock them. He begins to mock these 450 Israelite men who should have understood that you don't mess around with Yahweh. And so he says, shout louder. Maybe he's hard of hearing. And they carry on a bit longer. And maybe he's on vacation. Are you sure he's home? And as it carries on a little bit further again, he says, shout louder. Maybe he's asleep. You just need to wake him up. Well, eventually the 450 prophets of Baal go so far as to start slashing themselves with knives, hoping that the bloodletting would show how devoted they are to Baal, and Baal would respond on the basis of that, but nothing, nothing, nothing. And after they collapse in a sweaty heap, exhausted from all of their hours and hours of efforts, Elijah gets up and says, okay, guys, so it's my turn then. Here we go. Hang on a sec. He digs a trench around his altar and then has water poured all over the sacrifice, all over the altar, water after water after water, until that trench is completely full of water. The thing's totally soaked. If you took a torch and tried to light that up, nothing's going to happen. And then he prays a prayer that takes maybe 30 seconds to pray, and all of a sudden, boom, fire from heaven consumes the sacrifice, consumes the stones of the altar, consumes all of the water. Like, all that's left is this black, dark spot on the ground. And Elijah says, I think we knew who won here. And then in accordance with the Torah, arranged for the 450 prophets of Baal to be executed because they engaged in such heinous idolatry and was encouraging others to do so. Elijah wins. Elijah is at the top of the heap. Elijah showed in no uncertain terms that Yahweh was the God over Israel and not Baal. He succeeded. But, as we heard at the beginning of our reading this morning, Jezebel gets wind of this and then declares, Elijah, I am going to kill you. I'm killing you tomorrow. And Elijah gets afraid. Elijah freaks out. Elijah runs away. He's suddenly in despair. He's not liking what he's hearing. He runs away. He ends up dismissing his servant. He's convinced that his prophetic ministry is over, that that's it. It's done. He goes out into the wilderness all by himself and finds a solitary broom tree. Now, I don't really know what a broom tree is, but the point is it's solitary. Elijah feels alone. He goes off alone. He goes to a tree that's all by itself and just compounds this sense of being isolated, about being by himself. And now he's in despair and he says, God, I'm done. Like, just take my life. It's over. Like, just, that's it. I'm done. And then he falls asleep, exhausted, in despair, depressed. But then an angel wakes him up after a bit and says, get up, Elijah, you have to eat something. And Elijah finds, miraculously provided for him, this food. So he eats this food and then goes back to sleep. Then a little bit later again, the angel wakes him up again and says, Elijah, here's some more food. You got to eat. You need your strength for the journey you're going to undertake. So once again, he eats all of this food, and then he travels 40 days and 40 nights. Another miraculous thing happens on two meals. He goes for a month and a half and finds himself at Horeb, the mountain of God. That's simply another name for Mount Sinai, which is where Moses received the Torah from God. Elijah now is there, and he finds a cave. He crawls into a cave and sits there. So now he's even more alone. I just want to pause here for a second and say, I think there are times that we can relate to Elijah. I mean, we might ask the question, how on earth could he be so despondent after winning so significantly? But the thing of it is, he had outlaid a lot of energy in what he was doing, not just the showdown at Mount Carmel, but all of the efforts beforehand. He's doing the work of the Lord. He is doing what he's supposed to be doing, but evidently his exertion was so great and his concern about what might happen that he basically burned out. He'd worked so hard, he did all of this stuff, and he found himself at wit's end. Someone has said that fatigue makes cowards of us all. And I think that's what we see happening with Elijah. And I think we can identify with that, that there are times that we find ourselves growing weary. There are times that in our fatigue, we find ourselves being fearful. For me, it happens when I wake up in the middle of the night and then my mind starts going and I start thinking about all sorts of things. And then I can't get back to sleep because it's like, well, what about this? And what about that? And I have to remind myself it's the middle of the night and I can't do anything about it and I'm tired and that's why everything seems bigger. But that reality is nevertheless there. And this is where Elijah is, even to the point of being suicidal after having just been used by God in such an amazing way. He's burned out. He's wiped out. He's depressed. And all of us go through experiences where we feel depressed. Now, I understand, of course, there are those who are not just depressed, but deal with capital D depression. That mental health issue where it's a huge thing and it's more than just having a sad time. And nothing that I am saying today is meant to minimize the significance of that mental health concern. So please don't misunderstand me in that sense. But all of us experience times in which we are depressed, where we are tired and we are fearful. And Elijah is there, and I love it that Elijah is there, not at his expense, but because it points us in a good direction because of what God does with him afterwards. He's in this cave at the mountain of God, the hub of all things, the place representing the Torah that he was trying to defend. But then God comes to him and says this, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Now, anytime God asks a question in the scriptures, understand it's not that God is looking for information, because God already knows. It's not like God needs to be informed as to what's going on. God already gets it. But by asking the question, he's requiring Elijah to explain himself. He's requiring Elijah to put into words what he's feeling or what's going on for Elijah to hear what's happening. Kind of like a counseling or therapy session. So what's Elijah's response? He answers in a rather despondent, despairing way. He says, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant and thrown down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left and they are seeking my life to take it away." And so having poured out his heart, God then says to him, "All right, well, come out and stand on the mountain here. I'm about to pass by." And then there's this huge wind that's splitting rocks and then an earthquake and then fire, just like the fire from heaven a month and a half earlier. But the scriptures say God was not present in the wind, nor the earthquake, nor the fire. This is what Elijah would have expected when he had heard that God was going to pass by, because these are all symbols of the presence of God. Again, most notably the fire one, because Elijah had just experienced that. But God was not present in any of these things. God did not show up the way Elijah was expecting. But instead, there was simply what remained, a sheer, still silence. And in that silence, a still, small voice of God comes again. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah responds with exactly the same words as he did the first time. He hears the voice of God in the silence. His response is the same. He says, "I'm hearing your voice, Lord. I get it. You weren't in the earthquake and wind and fire, but here you are. But it's still the case. I'm still at my end. I think my ministry is over. I think I'm done. I don't think I have anything left to do. I am done." And God's response at that point is not to scold Elijah, not to tell him, "Are you forgetting who it is that you serve?" He's not saying, "Come on, man up, get over yourself." He's not saying any of that. But instead, God's response is to give Elijah instructions about what he is to do. Arise, get up, go to Damascus, and you have three people that you're going to anoint for particular purposes. One of them is going to be Elisha, the prophet who will succeed you. And in giving those instructions, what God is saying to Elijah is, I don't think you're done. I don't think it's over. You're afraid Jezebel's going to kill you? No, she's not, because you got to go and anoint these people. You think your prophetic ministry is over? No, it's not. You have to go and anoint the one who will succeed you, which means your ministry will come to its completion, but not yet. And he encourages Elijah simply to now carry on, knowing that he has indeed been strengthened by God, that God has taken care of his needs, and that God is able to continue to provide for him all that he needs to finish the task. God says to Elijah, no, you're not done. I am with you. I am with you even in the silence. We read Psalm 42 earlier together. And the psalmist in Psalm 42 is depressed. That's what we see in the words that were written. As the deer longs for the streams of water, so my soul longs for you, O Lord. My tears have been my food day and night, while everyone says to me, where is your God? The psalmist is experiencing a difficult time, whatever it is, and he's having to deal with people mocking him, saying, shout louder, maybe God's asleep. And he's saying, God, what am I supposed to do in all of this? And I'm longing for you. I'm longing for what I had before, but I'm not seeing it. I'm not there. But twice in that psalm, he comes to the same conclusion. Why are you cast down, O my soul? Why is my heart disquieted within me? Then he says, hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my help and my God. The psalm doesn't really end with a resolution, but an intention on the part of the psalmist to continue to hope in God. This is a good thing for us to hear, because all of us encounter times where we are convinced that tears are our food day and night. God is present in the silence. God is always present in the silence. And God's desire is for us to come to a place of true peace, true shalom, true wholeness. God's desire is for us to be able to move forward in God's strength, as God has always intended. And a significant thing for us to grasp is how God approaches us as revealed in that gospel reading. Jesus is encountering this man who is possessed by many demons. There's a lot of debate about what the nature of the demon possession is, and we don't need to get into the debate today, but let me simply say this. What we see revealed in the New Testament does not allow us to come to two conclusions about demon possession. Number one, a person can't be born demon possessed. It's not like that's the way the guy started life and that's the way it's always been. That can't happen. The second thing is, it can't just suddenly be imposed upon you. You can't be walking along and all of a sudden, you've gotten possessed by a demon now, and now what are we going to do? Like, that doesn't happen. So what that means is, this man is in this state of being possessed by many demons because of a course of action he would have taken in his life. Unwise choices, making decisions that weren't helpful, and now he finds himself in this desperate, despondent state of, one could say, slavery, because now he's outside of society, he's naked, he's living among tombs, and he's even got this amazing strength to break things that tie him down. He's in really rough shape, but it's going to be because of decisions he had made in his life. But when Jesus encounters him, Jesus doesn't care. Jesus does not say to this man, well, of course you're in this state. Look at how you've lived your life. You've made your bed, now you got to lie in it. Jesus doesn't say that. Jesus doesn't care what it is that happened to get this man to this place. Instead, Jesus is interested only in setting him free. And so Jesus takes it upon himself to heal him, to get rid of the demons, to get rid of this thing that is enslaving him. It's done. It's over with. He's healed. He's now dressed. He's in his right mind, sitting at the feet of Jesus. And in these two stories, We are given the encouragement that when we find ourselves in a dark place, not only is God present, but God is going to respond. It might be something instantaneous. It might be something dramatic where God takes it all upon God's self and simply sets us free. Or, as in the case of Elijah, it might be guiding us through important steps we have to take. You got to get sleep. You need to eat. You need to get up and get going. Maybe you need to talk to somebody. Both courses of action lead to restoration in the cases of both men. The bottom line is, even though the courses of action are different, God is at work. God is always present. God is present in the silence. In the midst of our despair, we can always know that God hears, God sees, God knows. And so we can ask ourselves, why are you cast down, O my soul? Why is my heart disquieted within me? Put your hope in God, your help, and your salvation. Amen.